Welcome to the Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
We did it. We made it to Friday, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of the All Talk edition of The Social. Lainey and Jess will be joining later on. Aaliyah Jasmine back in studio with me. We are thrilled to welcome our first guest for this All Talk edition. Joining us now from Treaty Number 7 in Alberta, Chief Communications Specialist Nicole Robertson joins. Welcome to The Social.
Nicole. Hi.
And
hello.
Also from Toronto, our good friend, actor, comedian Miguel Rivas is back. Hello, Miguel.
Hello, yeah. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, we got a lot of great stuff to get to today, so why don't we dive right in. Miguel, welcome to the show, and let's talk about menopause. Is that a nice opener? So The Telegraph reporting that a huge accounting firm in California is training managers on how to talk to their staff about menopause. While some say this could combat the stigma around women's health in the office, others are worrying it could actually reinforce certain stereotypes. So as the male, resident male on the panel today, do you think that it's up to the employer or a company to offer menopause awareness courses?
Well, I'm glad you threw to me first, because I feel like my opinion is important to be front and center here in this conversation on menopause. You know, and initially, my instinct is to say that I think it's a really good idea. I feel like the stigma around menopause and other periods in women's lives are something that men hold in a poor fashion, and this could be very beneficial. Now, it feels like maybe this company bungled the rollout and how they were planning to do it, but it does feel like this could be a step forward in having everyone understand what everyone else is going through, because that's all we really need is just a little understanding, right?
Nicole, do you agree?
So absolutely, I agree that there should be an understanding that essentially it does come into play in everyday type of life. I know for myself, I'm going through that, and I know that, you know, in the mornings I heat right up, and in fact, you know, doing television and broadcasting, both.
So would it help if your coworkers knew about that?
Yes, and that's the thing, is that, you know, it's not just the hot flashes. It could be some moodiness. It could be to do with even, you know, other women get much more, you know, symptomatic around, you know, everything that you can imagine. And I think to ourselves as females, as women, as older women, you know, we've, for myself, I'm a mother. So I've gone through the whole thing of you know, birthing, and now I'm at this time in my life where I'm going, okay, now it's a different scenario. And I think that men and all other people should learn about this. This is a normal, natural thing that women go through as early as the 30s now, because of all the hormones in the food system. So.
You know, one of the things you said is this is a normal thing that you go through, and it's something that you're dealing with personally. And I'm so curious, you know, do you feel that if the men around you did understand, if they went to these, you know, courses and like learned about this stuff, would it be educational for them? Or would it, you feel, Nicole, like going through what you're going through right now, would you feel like it would alienate you, that knowing that, you know, maybe your moods are affected or your temperature is affected, that it might put you in a vulnerable position? And as you
maybe
say,
more stigmatized?
More stigmatized, and especially at a time, which, you know, I think Nicole really aptly pointed out, that women especially face ageism in the workplace.
Yes.
So is this another thing that will go against you and alienate you? What do you think about that? Will it help or hinder you in the workplace?
You know, I think it will help. I look at, you know, some of the parts of, you know, being the word alienated and being a First Nations Cree woman, and, you know, the stuff that we're going through right now as far as the reconciliation in this country. I think, you know, having those discussions, they sometimes alienate me. So having these discussions is just another part of, you know, let's learn about it instead of trying to push it away. And I think that that's,
I like that.
Okay,
you guys,
important.
I need to hear all of you chime in on this, because Jennifer on Facebook, I'm dying over this. She writes, "I don't believe the workplace is where this should be discussed. I do think it perpetuates the myth that something is wrong when a woman goes through menopause. Should we also discuss men's issues? Erectile dysfunction? Enlarged prostate? Where's the course for the prostates, men? We need to know what's going on down there. I mean, this is the one thing where I stand is like, do we need courses on how to be a full empathetic human? Because I do know, Miguel, I know you want to jump in on this, because I guess the question is, what is going, is the workplace truly the right place? I think I like the intent.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't know if that's the right place, mm-hmm. Miguel.
I want to talk about my prostate as much as possible. I want that information out there. I don't want any secrets from the public or from my friends as it relates,
Miguel,
to my prostate.
I would also like to learn about your prostate.
Wow.
I feel like that. I do.
Currently
feel like...
healthy. Currently great, healthy great. And doing fine. I think men have a hard time discussing a lot of things. I think there's a built up sort of stigma that men have against themselves for revealing anything and discussing specifically mental health issues, but any sort of medical issue. And I think it's sort of difficult to know how to take the step forward into pushing men to feel more comfortable and discussing things that they might feel embarrassed about, let's say.
Yeah, you know
but it's
what?
Important.
I think everyone just touched on a really good point, which is perhaps the workplace isn't the right place to learn about it. Maybe it should be at school or something like that. But for a lot of people of an older generation, that time has passed to learn about this in school. So maybe it's a great thing that the private sector is doing this in their workplace. Anyways, let's move on to some relationship drama.
Yes.
Okay, so a woman has written into the Washington Post with her dilemma. Here's the deal. Her fiance is upset because she started wearing her grandmother's ring on her wedding finger after they had already decided against an engagement ring. So he's upset about this. Is she in the wrong? Nicole, what do you think?
I don't think that she's in the wrong for wanting to wear a ring. I know that I have a personal story around this, is that I was engaged and the ring that I had was from my fiance. And then we broke up and got back together, which is another whole story. But I bought this ring here, which I promised myself that I would be always true, one to, you know, self-acceptance, self-love, all these things. So that represents that to me. I don't see it an issue for her to be wearing the ring. I think that with her
fiance. One go, Nicole? Where did the first engagement ring go? Just curious.
So actually, I kept that for my daughter.
Because
it's her dad, and she could make it into, say, you know, a pendant, anything.
She's going to bust it up. She's not going to keep it a ring, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes, maybe. So I put it in a time capsule for her.
Oh, that is so sweet. I was going to ask Miguel, because in this story, the fiance is upset. He's upset. He's like, if you wanted a ring, you should have just told me.
Yeah.
I would have gotten you a ring to make you happy, but we said no ring. So, like, he's kind of he's stuck between a rock and a hard place.
I think we need Miguel's opinion this male opinion on this.
Well, I think what's very clear is that this couple has a wonderful set of communication skills between them. They obviously know how to speak to each other and are on the same page.
Fair.
You know, I sort of balk at the idea that symbols like a wedding ring, which I am currently wearing, I'm married, that it has to be all significant. You know, if there's many reasons why people can't wear a ring, whether it's allergies or, you know, weight gain or all kinds of reasons that you can go in and out of wearing a wedding ring, even specific tasks, whether you're working out or not. So I don't want to be too attached to it, but I do know that it means something different to different people.
Yeah.
A small story for me is that I lost my wedding ring about a year and a half ago.
Why was it off in the first place? Moving on.
I was on set on a TV show and I took it off. Anyways, I lost it.
Don't
and I didn't think it was
trouble.
That big of a deal. Oh, I was in huge trouble, just massive trouble. My wife was devastated. It was like a complete nightmare. But luckily, I was able to buy another ring. And then when we went out on our anniversary, I took out a box and then took out a ring and put it on myself.
Aww.
And she teared
something.
Up and it was romantic and it kind of ended up being a win for me, I think.
Oh, I love that.
That's
really
so
good.
Sweet.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know who's deciding to call me in the middle of the show. Mom, call me
It's
later.
Ryan. He's like, Ryan. Are you wearing your ring?
Are you wearing your ring?
I got you.
You know, that's my husband. He's just checking. It was actually the ring ringing. It was just, he's got a tracker on it. Just kidding. No, for me, I think that when it comes to rings, I think you hit it on the head, Miguel. It does mean different things for different people.
Right.
It was very clear. Like, I was like, oh, sure, I think an engagement ring would be nice, but I never even thought I wanted to get married.
Right.
And so I never thought that I'd be attached to some of the traditions that, as a proud feminist, I was like, oh, I'm going to eschew all of these patriarchal traditions. And yet I really did find myself going, you know, I really think that that's actually lovely. And yeah. So I think this woman can be okay to say to her fiance, I might have changed my mind. And maybe I do want a ring. So totally. Maybe this is their first big test before they actually get married, if they end up getting there.
And there's a lot about the financial element of it. Yeah. Like, oh, it's too expensive to have a ring, which is very reasonable and understandable. But does it have to be a super expensive ring? Isn't it just the symbol of wearing a ring as
a
dedication to someone?
And this one was free. She got it from her grandma. And if he has a problem with that, he should have bought her a ring to begin with.
Yeah, I know. They need to talk. Just talk. Sit down and talk.
Okay, so if cooking dinner for the family has you feeling the heat, especially with Thanksgiving coming around the corner, I've got some good news for you. Experts told the HuffPost that if forcing everyone around the dinner table is too stressful, there are other ways to bond with your loved ones. So how important is the family dinner to you? Like on a weekly basis, a nightly basis, how important is that family dinner to you? Nicole, what do you think?
So I don't really think that the family dinner is, you know, sacred to me. I look at it for my daughter and I, because it's a smaller, you know, setting, that we will catch up and take our actual meal and watch our favorite show, which I know sounds really, you know, oh my goodness. but I think to myself, you know, going for a walk down by the river, being in nature and actually having moments with her in that way is much more sacred and much more opening, you know, new conversations that maybe she wouldn't have been open to. So I think that that's sort of like an older school way of looking at things.
Oh, it's old school, but I love it. It sounds so beautiful. And I like the mother-daughter bond. It's like, I hope my daughter, when she's older, wants to even walk with me or be seen in public with me. But growing up, I come from an immigrant household, and it was every single night a non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. My father would have everybody at the dinner table. You had your seat. It was non-negotiable. It didn't matter if you were dying of the flu. It didn't matter if you had assignments to do for school. My dad expected you there. And at the time, you're just like, oh, you know, you do the kid thing. Like, oh, my gosh, we have to do this. But I'll tell you something. It is not only a tradition that ended up becoming one of my favorite parts of my life growing up.
Yeah.
I've done that now with my family. And we don't just do dinner. We do breakfast and dinner.
Oh, my gosh.
Virtually 6 to 7 days a week.
That's because Marquesa's young enough that she still likes you.
That's
guys.
What I'm saying. I have to do it while she likes me and thinks I might be this cool because I know that's going to go.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be cool anymore.
Come.
But I will say this. It's not just my family, and I feel like the stability it brought me as a kid, and I hope I'm giving my daughter, but there have been so many studies that have shown that kids are physically and mentally healthier if they have at least 3 dinners with the family every single night of the week. Harvard Family Dinner Project. They've been studying dinner at home for 20 years. So amazing data that shows if you can pull it off, everybody's healthier for it.
Oh, so that's really interesting. I'm going to read a comment here from Facebook. This is from Alicia on Facebook, who says, my family has never been able to have nightly dinners together because my dad always worked in the afternoon or night shift. It hasn't made a big difference to our family relationships. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, you talk about the Harvard studies, but I also come from an immigrant family. And my experience was much like Alicia's, where my dad was never home. He ran a restaurant. He was never there for dinners. He was never there when I woke up. So oftentimes, actually, when my parents ran a family business together, family restaurant together, my sister and I like ate in the kitchen in the back. And some of the kitchen staff would make us dinners. So I think it's like, you know, being able to have a family dinner is oftentimes this thing that's given to us by the media. It's a very normal thing that we're all supposed to do.
Privilege thing.
It's a privilege thing for a lot of people that's
and
really hard to
And a wholesome thing too, I think, in a Western sort of viewpoint. Mm-hmm. I think that it's completely comes from sort of this white collar, blue collar idea around what is, you know, it comes from a different part of the world. And so from my perspective, I think that, you know, food is sacred, absolutely. I look at it and I think one day of like Sundays we have a sit down meal at the table, but we don't have a big family. And it's her and I. And being a teenager, she's like, you know what, Mom, like, let's not make it so formal. Let's just go and sit together. And so I think that for different families, it means different things. And so if you have a big family, and of course, you know, I have two older sisters, I have, you know, Mom and Dad, we'd sit down and have a meal. And I grew up like that, but I'm making my own traditions. And I think that's so important, to honor yourself in your own parenting and what you want to, you know, raise your child in. And yeah, it's not always so black and white.
I have three brothers very close in age, and we're all sort of extrovert kind of loud talkers. And I feel that the family dinner that we had, because we had it every night growing up as well, it was sort of an unbreakable tradition. And for us, it was sort of like a comedy training ground. You wanted to be funnier than everyone else at the table. And we used to have this pact with my youngest brother that I feel guilty about now, even though it's funny, which is, for a year, every time he would make a joke, we would go stone-faced.
Oh, no.
And not laugh at his joke. And I feel like it made him into a tough guy. And so, you know, I think we all want to sort of replicate the good versions of what we had growing up. So for me, that was such a formative time that I have tried to implement that with my family. I have two small kids, but it's obviously very different because they're very small. And it can break apart, and you don't want to adhere to it too strictly. Mm-hmm. But if there is some value there, it's nice to kind of continue that tradition if it meant something to you, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I do want to say this Harvard Family Dinner Project, affluent families are spending more time together at dinner, and low-income families spending less time.
Well, there you go.
I mean, listen, I mean, the privilege is sort of baked
in. Sign of our times. And who's working during the pandemic, and who's
precisely
able to stay at home and work. Yeah, absolutely.
So we're going to go from food to fashion, I guess hair fashion. Guys watching, we know you're out there. Can you pull off the middle part? Because GQ is now telling you this look is very advanced, whatever that means. But as demonstrated by musician Billie Eilish's brother, Phineas, I love how we have to put that marker on. He's Billie Eilish's brother, Phineas.
Yeah.
It can look absolutely righteous, they say. Again, Miguel, we're leaning on you really heavily. That was a really interesting look there. Could you pull that off?
Kind of has the middle part right
you
now.
You know,
I feel
of,
like, am I doing that now?
Do.
Maybe I can adjust it just to pull the part a little bit over,
more,
maybe.
A little more,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like in the pandemic, something that I came out with is that, like, we should all be a bit more daring with our looks in general. We should be trying different things. I feel like men have had such short cropped hair for so long that the pandemic forced everyone to just grow it out and get a little bit wild.
Yeah.
And you have to sort of experiment with what works there. I tried a middle part for like 3 months in the middle of the pandemic, and I kind of think I was rocking it a little bit. Now it kind of just falls a bit naturally because I'm a bit of a bum that way. But I feel like if you can pull it off, you should. And if you don't know if you can, you should try.
I love the middle part. Oh my God.
On a guy?
Oh my God. I know you're making faces at me, but all my crushes from the 90s had middle parts. And you think about it, for women, 90s fashion and beauty is coming back.
Yes.
So why not for men? Like, let's think about the dreamboats of the 90s, okay? We have Leonardo DiCaprio, we have Brad Pitt.
He had a
hardcore middle part for a lot of the 90s.
Okay.
Leonardo DiCaprio, middle part for a lot of the 90s. Okay. Nick Carter from the Backstreet Boys.
That's
bad. That looks bad.
Yeah, that was bad then and
bad now. But back then, lots of girls were over that. And then 2021 example, Chris Hemsworth has a middle part on most of his red carpets.
Because he has long hair now.
But it's still a middle part, and he rocks it.
With long hair, you can rock a middle part.
Oh, well, 100%. Now you're being elite to the level of the length of your hair.
When you have thin hair, you cannot rock the middle part. Let me just tell you, because it will just look like you're balding. And I'm not trying to be mean when I say that. You know, you look at the Caesar hairdo that back in the 90s. You remember that? With the men had the forward-looking hair.
And if you
had thin hair, it looked awful. And I'm so sorry to say that for people that have thinning hair. But the thing is that you have to have thicker hair.
It's a natural thing, Nicole. Some of us are losing our hair and we try to hide it as much as we can.
I'm not shaming thin hair. In fact, that's a part of the whole premenopause stuff, but I'm trying to keep my mane. I'm trying to keep it.
I'm loving it. To all of you boys out there who are thinking of doing the middle part, I'm saying do it. I like it.
Just don't make me try to pull off the Ross Geller, you know, where we go forward and flip up.
Yeah, let's not
as soon
do
as that,
that
comes back, I'm out.
I love that. Hey, listen, I'm glad that we went all the places that we did, Nicole and Miguel. Thank you so much for joining the All Talk Edition today. A ton of fun with you both.
Joining us now all the way from Nashville are co-authors of the new novel, We Are Not Like Them. We're talking about Christine Pride and Joe P. Atza. Welcome to the show, you two.
Oh, we're so happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
We are so excited to have you both with us today because we have some topics to get into with both of you. So a piece in Slate is arguing that interracial friendships don't go far enough in fixing racism. And the phrase, some of my best friends are black, kills a lot of important conversations. So Christine and Joe, as a pair of friends from different backgrounds, curious to know your thoughts on this.
Yeah, we've got, how much time do we have?
We got thoughts. We wrote a whole book about this.
I mean, so the first thing we want to say is that we think interracial friendships are a great first step. And I don't want to say curing racism.
You know what, Joe? I don't know if you can hear me, but we're having a few audio issues. So I think that we are going to fix those. But, you know, why don't you weigh in, Jess, first before, you know, we can hear from Christine and Joe, just why we fix those. Like, what do you think about, like, well, you know, having a friend from a different, me, for example, me. What have you learned from me?
Oh, my gosh, Lainey, I think it's absolutely critical. And you've changed my life. It's true. But I've also been thinking about this sort of on a grander scope in terms of Canada. And by virtue of geography, this is sometimes a tricky thing to do. And it sort of raised a couple of red flags to me. Like, heaven forbid someone is trying to be overly, like, to push a friendship. Do you know what I mean? Like, you want a friendship to come around organically.
Yeah.
And so the idea of, like, a horrible person who's, like, from a sketch comedy bit, who's trying to collect different friends of color, like baseball cards, that is rather off-putting as well, you know?
Yeah.
Do we have you guys back?
We do. I think we have you both back. Christine and Joe?
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear us now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. And we've been waiting to find out, like, yeah, what your experience has been. You started with saying it's a good first step.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we think it's a good first step because when you are friends with someone and you know their story and you love them and you feel empathy towards them, I think then you start to see the world and in a different way and how they see the world in a different way. So when there are things that happen in the news that have to do with race, your opinion includes your opinion of your friend. And you want to fix those things that have been difficult for that person in their life. But I love what you just said about, it's also, we all say we want more diverse friends. We want to diversify our circle. But what does that mean? Like, what are you supposed to do? Go up to, like, a black woman in the grocery store and
my
be like,
God,
do you like Real Housewives?
Yeah, don't do that. But it also, as you said, it has to come from a place of authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to meet a person and have a genuine connection with them. It can't just be like, oh, you're black or you're X or you're Y. You know, I'm going to be friends with you.
I'd like to put you in my pocket now.
I love what you guys were saying about the idea of it not only coming about organically and authentically, but also the idea of seeing the actual race. Because I think we've done away with it recently. I hope we have. But, like, I don't see color. Like, that's just a sort of a stupid thing to say. Most people can recognize that it's a stupid thing to say. So actually seeing your friends of color, seeing their color and acknowledging it and honoring it is a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful
thing. Absolutely. I mean, I'm a black woman and I want to show up in my relationship with Joe as a black woman. Mm-hmm. And I want her to appreciate my experiences as a black woman and not just like I love you even though you're black, or I love you, I don't see that you're black, right? Like, that's not the
point. Or I love you more because you're black, which then gets creepy.
You know, you want to have it be authentic and genuine.
Yeah. I think saying colorblind, I think when people said they were colorblind, it originally did come from a good space. Like, they were well-meaning. But we're now realizing, we're like, so are you just ignoring this part of my identity that is so important to me? You would never do that to a good friend. And we also think that, you know, sometimes people ignored it, particularly white people, because it was just easier and it was more comfortable. And we want our friendships to be a safe place. We don't want to make our friendships more difficult on purpose.
Right.
And so that's the reason that a lot of people don't necessarily talk about race or touch that third rail of race in their friendships, because they're like, isn't it just more fun to have some mimosas and get our nails done and talk about The Bachelor?
But yet we found that the more we've talked about race, the more we've shared our experiences with each other, the closer we've gotten. I mean, that's how you bring your friendship to the next level, by being honest and open and vulnerable about everything. And that includes race.
And as part of that, you know, I'm curious, creating space between both of you for blind spots. I mean, of course, you two love each other as friends, but you know, let's face it, one of you is white. Your experience is not going to have the breadth of like knowledge and experience and maybe even trauma as your friend. So you may step in it, right? Like, and you have to have the space to go through those stumbles, right?
That has happened. I think it's space and facing Grace. Our fears on both sides, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think sometimes as a black person, you're scared to talk about race or to bring up an experience because you don't know if the person is going to be defensive or dismissive or, you know, more upset than you are even. And so for my part, that sometimes makes me a little nervous just in general. And I think, you know, you have different fears, right?
Yeah. And as a white person, I did get defensive, you know, so many of the times when we started talking about race, or when Christine was like, why don't you have more black friends? And I'm like, oh, am I being attacked? Or I want to talk about this, but I'm afraid of feeling stupid and saying the wrong thing. And then will I offend my friend and end our friendship? So everyone has these anxieties. Everyone is nervous. We're not acknowledging why we have them or that we are even having them. And then it just shuts the conversation down. And when we just do need to be talking more, but also to give each other the grace to mess up and not be perfect all the time. I mean, I despise the world of cancel culture because I think it has shut down a lot of conversations because you're just scared. You're scared of saying the wrong thing or being offensive. And I think a lot of people do want to try to have these conversations, but they don't want to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, Christine and Joe, I have to say, you look like two peas in a pod, and your friendship looks so gorge. But this is
made of our outfit.
I love it. But this is your first time working as co-authors, and the two of you developed the story for your novel together. So, where did the idea come from?
So I met Joe when I was her editor at Simon & Schuster, actually. I was still working full-time then, and we just worked so well together. And when we finished her wonderful novel, Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, we wanted to keep working together. And I'd had this idea kind of simmering for a while.
For a long time. Yeah. I mean, I think book editors think of ideas all the time and they're like, I should get someone to write this. And Christine, there have been so many shootings of black men in America. And she had long been thinking, like, as a black woman, what would happen to my friendship if my friend were married to a cop who did this, who enacted violence against a black man? Would we survive that? And she never thought she would write it herself.
No. And also we saw a unique opportunity to partner together, right? It would have been a different book if either of us wrote it separately. What we wanted to do was work on it together, not just because we wanted to, you know, work on something else together, but also because I could bring my experience as a black woman. She could bring her experience as a white woman. Mm-hmm. And so we could make a better book because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. A richer book. And we want to let everyone know We Are Not Like Them is out now. So make sure to pick up a copy. Just not quite yet. Because here's what we're talking about next. This is apropos. What's the best exit strategy when you're leaving a party? Someone wrote to Miss Manners to ask if they need to go up to every single person and say, bye-bye, thanks for having me, bye-bye. So what do you guys think? see you shaking your head.
So many thoughts. Also, by the way, guys, the pillow sitting next to you is so distracting because it's the same colors as our book. And I keep thinking it is a big...
You did that on purpose.
Pillow. Look at it. It's a big pillow of our book. I love it.
You're
so
welcome.
I will Irish goodbye all day long. If I have learned anything as a fully grown 40-year-old woman, it's that no one is paying as much attention to you as you think they are. No one is going to miss you. You just leave the party. They assume that you went to the bathroom. They assume that you know. And then they forget about you.
Oh, there you go. See?
Goodbye.
I didn't even notice.
I didn't notice.
Nobody was offended by that.
It depends on the situation, though, guys. Like, you're not going to French exit at a dinner party for six people before dessert.
It depends on how many people, or on
live TV, Lainey. She's so nice.
That was a bad move, Lainey. No, but if you're in a big party, you can absolutely walk out. And if you're, I think the less said, the better at a dinner party. You don't need to say, go up to every single person, but you stand up and announce to the table. No, I am also all for being very honest now. I'm just like,
I gotta go.
I'm exhausted. My bedtime is 8:30. I am an old woman with two children. Goodbye.
I think this is a fun problem to think about because I haven't been to a party in so long.
I actually have, and I hear what everybody is saying, and yet I do also think that there are certain people who are always early leavers. You peg them as
like us,
the Irish exiters. Yeah. And I don't know that you want that reputation either. If you're going to be an early exiter once in a while, everybody has a reason. I get it. But I don't know if you want that to be like, hey, Jess, comma, the early leaver. I mean, I went to a wedding last weekend. And I am very good friends with a constant early leaver. And she wanted to sneak out of the wedding. And I sold her out. I snitched on her. She was trying to get out of the party. I told the bride, I was like, there and there and there and there and there. The bride did cause a scene, ran to the front, like the entrance, and like stopped the early leaver from leaving. But here's why. The bride said, this is the most important day of my life. I love today because not only am I marrying the love of my life, but because all the people I love are around me. And you were going to say goodbye or leave without saying goodbye. I didn't want it to go down that way. And I feel like I took the bride's side and the early leaver had to stay and do a proper goodbye. So sorry.
Okay, let's side with the bride for now. So hashtags like child free by choice and not having kids have gotten popular on the TikTok over the past year. It's mainly women making videos explaining their reasoning for not having children. So do you think this helps combat this stigma around being child-free by choice? What do you guys think?
Yes, absolutely. I love this so much, especially as someone who is child-free by choice. You know, it does feel like it's a decision that you have to defend all of the time. And, you know, you would not believe the stuff that people say to me sometimes, like, you'll change your mind, or God wants you to have kids, or just the why, you know, that you have to explain and explain. Mm-hmm. And it's like the default is you have kids. And if you don't, there's a lot of shame and stigma. So the more people, the more women who stand up and say, no, every choice is valid. Mm-hmm. I'm allowed to make this choice. And, you know, I have the freedom to do that. And that should be celebrated just as much as celebrating women who do have kids, because both are great pathways. And so I think it's great that people are just out there being proud about it.
No, you go.
Exactly.
I'm a supporter. I'm an ally.
You're an ally.
I'm an ally. I do have two children. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Adorable.
So great. But I've written about this a lot, about the like overly effusive attention that mothers get in our world and on social media. The Instagram algorithm loves mothers. They love pregnant bellies. And too many of the stories that have always been told, and we have a mutual friend who wrote a book about this that Christine edited, have ended with marriage and babies for women. I mean, like, almost every sitcom ever ends with marriage and babies. I'm like, everyone on Friends got married and had a baby at the end of it. And now that we're finally seeing narratives of another way for a woman to live in the world, It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's so refreshing.
And you guys, I think younger women need to see that too, right? That that's not the only way to be. So if you're 20 and seeing these TikTok videos, then you feel like you have more options out there. You know, that it's not just this is the expected path that women are supposed to take and do this or else, right? And so if you see other women doing it and feeling good about it, then, you know, it opens a world to you.
I have to say, Christine and Joe, you're making me sort of entirely rethink this topic because I'm child-free by choice as well, oh my God, but it's not like my partner and I are sitting around the dining room table every night, like high-fiving, being like, child-free by choice. Like, we don't really celebrate it, and here's why, because I'm not too sure I've entirely felt the stigma of it. As you were saying, Christine, I can't remember the last time where I felt sort of confronted with someone saying that, like, you're going to regret it. And the few occasions where someone has sort of suggested, like, you should have kids, you know, it's going to change your life, I'm always just flattered that they think I'm that young. You know what I mean? But, like, like, guys.
Yeah, there's another thing. I wonder how long I could stay child-free by choice, that it's just child-free by default. I don't even know.
No, I think I agree with you, Jess. I mean, I think 15 years ago, I'm also child-free by choice, and 15 years ago, I did get those questions like, you're going to change your mind, or why won't you change your mind, or whatever. I agree with everything that's been said. I certainly understand, like, that it's so irritating that in stories that we tell, women only have one choice and one path. I just don't know that it has to be a movement. Like, I just don't know that I don't know that we have to be out there, like, crusading on, like, there are other movements and this is a movement. And the reason why is because people who are child-free by choice are pretty happy. It's a momentary, like, for me, in my experience, it's a momentary irritation when some idiot is like, you're going to change your mind. And the moment passes, and then I'm back to my awesome child-free life. You know, like, I'm not being held back from opportunities that require a movement for me to go out on social media with these hashtags. Like, you know, I'm not being denied entry into rooms because of this choice.
That's an excellent point.
Right? And so where I do want to apply more sensitivity, though, are people who are child-free not by choice. Right. I think that that is a real pain and a real trauma. And I know people who have been through that situation, are going through that situation. And those questions aren't a momentary irritation. When somebody says, why don't you have kids? They don't get to go home and high five somebody and be like, child-free by choice. They go home realizing that there's a real loss in their life. And so I think that if there's a movement that we need to have, I prefer that the movement and the placards and the hashtags be on their behalf rather than on behalf of someone like me, because again, I'm okay. You know what I mean?
But I think all women should celebrate all our choices, because I do think it's amazing when people come forward and talk about their miscarriages or their struggles having babies, right? There's like strength in community. Yeah. So that's great. I think we all need to shout all of our choices as valid.
Space. I like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on, because it's Thanksgiving weekend here in Canada. And so Thanksgiving is about family, right? Yep. Family and food. So the question is, what do you think are the most underrated Thanksgiving dishes?
Things are going to get spicy, no?
So, we saved the most controversial topic for last.
I think that we are going to evoke a Twitter firestorm with what we're about
let's
to say.
Let's do it.
So I just want to get rid of the turkey. Why is the turkey the enduring symbol of Thanksgiving? Last year, we had weird COVID Thanksgiving with just like my husband and my two kids, and we just did sides. Mm-hmm. It was all side Thanksgiving. Got the mashed potatoes and the green beans and the macaroni and cheese and the sweet potatoes and the cranberries. And then I mix it all together on the plate. And it was amazing. Mm. Not a turkey in sight. And I didn't miss it. I have no love for the turkey. And I think the sides should be the ultimate Thanksgiving food, because that's what everyone loves.
Yes.
I'm actually going to double down on that, because I actually don't really like any Thanksgiving food. So like turkey,
that's just
cranberry sauce, green bean casserole. Mashed what are all the other ones? I do like mashed
potatoes. Oh, thank you. Oh, good. I was going to start crying.
I'm not.
You're not a heathen.
I'm not a monster. I mean, who doesn't like mashed potatoes?
Okay, here's an important question for you guys, though. Because, Joe, you're in good company with Lainey, who really detests a turkey.
I hate turkey.
But here's a question. Yeah. I think gravy is the essential ingredient at Thanksgiving. I think it's a very key component because it can fix a rotten turkey, a rotten dry turkey. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have the turkey and you have the sides, how do you get the gravy, guys?
The mashed potatoes and the stuffing.
But you need the gravy on that too. Like you were talking about, mix it all up on the plate and then jam it in your face.
Right, but I put the gravy on that. That's where I put the gravy.
But how do you make the gravy without the turkey?
Can you only make gravy from a turkey? Can you make it out of a box?
Don't you need the drippings from the turkey?
I have done gravy without turkey dripping.
Okay.
I would rather no turkey and a gravy out of a box and powder than have a turkey. Yeah.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. Can't you buy gravy from a box?
Yeah.
You can buy it from a can.
There you go.
You can buy it from a can.
We have solved the world's problems.
All right now. Well, what are you guys going to make?
Well, we're not a turkey, but definitely turkey.
It's a Chinese Thanksgiving. So it's going to be pork belly, barbecue pork. All kinds of stir fry, probably Peking Beijing duck. So, yeah, we are not going to be doing a dry turkey.
I'm going to figure out how to get invited to Lainey's Thanksgiving as hard as I can. That's incredible. Christine and Joe, thank you so much for being with us today.
We loved being here. It was so fun. Thanks for having us.
Subscribe to The Social Podcast so you don't miss a fiery debate. Until next time, socialites.